Hello, and welcome to the Empowerography Podcast. This is a platform created for women's voices to be heard and a place to share their stories, journeys, and successes with the world for the purpose of helping other women who might be on similar journeys. We are empowering women one episode at a time. I'm your host, Brad Walsh, so kick back, grab one of your favorite beverages, and enjoy the stories. The world needs to hear your message and your story, so don't deny the world of that gift within you that the universe has given you. Someone out there needs to hear your story because it will support them in feeling hope, inspired, and even transformed. Do you want to discover how I help get my clients out of their own way, show up, and confidently share their message? I would love to extend an invitation to you to join me in my free masterclass, Start Your Own Podcast from Idea to Implementation, on Wednesday, April 5th at 1 p.m. Eastern. You can find the registry link in the show notes. Hope to see you there. Hello there, Brad Walsh here, your host of the Empowerography Podcast. Today, my guest is Pi Isis. She is a visionary leader, a philanthropist, an educator, an advocate, and the founder of PS314, a consulting agency serving as a matchmaking engine for social change. Welcome, Pi. I am so happy to have you here. I cannot wait to jump in. Thank you for taking and making the time to be here with me today. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for the invite. I'm excited to be here and dive in and have a nice morning chat.
It is my pleasure and my honor. So with that being said, let's jump right in. Now, that is a hell of a lot of hats you wear, quite a resume. And it seemed that everything is kind of tied in quite closely together and intertwined with one another. How do you find the time for all of this? And how important is prioritization and organization for you?
Oh, it's critically important. I live by my calendar. If it's not on the calendar, everything is on the calendar.
If it's not on the calendar, it's not happening.
It can't happen. I just onboarded a new operations team and I was sharing with them how important it is to put everything on here. We can't even talk about, oh, we'll have a meeting on this day, because if we don't put it on, something else will come up. And I know for sure one thing about me, I can't hold it all in my head. So it's one of the first things I look at in the morning is, what's my day going to be? What's happening for me? It'll tell me how I need to appear, if I'm going to be on camera, if it's a day that I can get a workout in early in the morning, or if I have plans later. So kind of actually be outside of the virtual world and be in person. So it kind of shifts me a little bit. But they always say your business identity is defined by what you do in times of crisis and in times of bliss. And it's one of three. So you're either the practitioner, like the artist, the producer, and I'm an artist for sure, or you're that visionary, the entrepreneur who has really great ideas. I know a lot of people like that who just continue to inspire me, and I certainly have ideas that I'll share with people. Or you're the person who is ensuring that every piece is connected and stays on the track, and you're going to make it to A to Z. For me, my natural ability is to be the conductor, to know the process is in place. I was raised by a producer.
There you go.
But it gives me great ease away from my anxiety if I know things are happening. And it's even for our consulting teams, that's the first thing that they are tasked with is, what is our RASCI matrix, our responsibility matrix for the team? It helps the clients understand how we all operate. It's always a team.
Yeah.
You know, individual consultants who've never worked together sometimes understand, how do I play in this sandbox and still be a leader? What are my responsibilities and expectations? And so I find that organization is really critically important.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm very curious, with you wearing so many hats, what does your morning routine look like?
Yeah. You know, it's so funny when I saw the question, I try not to talk to anyone before 10 or 11 a.m.
Really?
Yeah. And I used to be a person that could do an all-nighter if I needed to just push all the way through.
Yeah.
I usually don't take meetings after 6 or 7. And granted, our company is virtual and we have people in all different time zones, but we try to have a 7 to 7 window prime Monday through Friday. Not that I don't work sometimes on the weekends, not that I don't work late at night, but that 10 to 5 or 6 Eastern time is usually the chunk of time that I'll give to engaging. I want to be present, but I need the time off at the end of the night to actually have my life and to get my day started. So in the morning, lots of cuddles with my puppy, my partner, and We'll go for a walk with coffee if he has time to, or yeah. sometimes take the puppy out. And lots of water and supplements. I'm a big believer in holistic preventative care for myself because of the type of pace and type of life I want to live. I usually will check kind of the zeitgeist to see what's happening in the world. Sometimes that comes in through text messages, social media, NPR, the newspaper, New York Times, or emails. And then once I kind of know what's happening, that's when I disconnect from it and I'll light candles and incense, play some music or a podcast or a YouTube special, and I'll just listen to it over an audiobook as right. I just get my day together, stretch and take a look at it. And then I can respond to emails and do a little bit of writing and prepare for actually being present in the space. That way I'm not really rushed into
easing into it.
Yeah, it makes me a better person.
And I'm sure that your team appreciates that, and it's just an easier flow for the day.
Yeah.
Yeah. What drives, motivates, and inspires you to keep going and excelling at all that you do?
I do wear a lot of hats, but I don't wear them all at once. So there are a lot of things that I've been, and they're part of me, part of my identity. But I would say that my day is primarily running my company. I don't teach any longer at this time, and I don't really mentor in a formal way. Sometimes I'll have others come in time to time and I'll ask if I can coach them. But yeah. for the most part, it really is my business. And it's interesting because I've had the great opportunity to be able to choose the work that I do throughout my entire career. And I guess we all do in some way, right?
Yep.
And with clients, I really believe in the work. I believe in wanting to find the answer to alleviate a pain point. And when I vet and invite individuals to come and work on projects, that's one of the things that they also have to be in alignment with. Do you really believe in wanting to solve the problem? Because it gets really tight sometimes,
yeah.
right? Where there are things that are just not in our scope of work. And there's personalities and there's life that happens and there are delays that happens and there are unknowns that happens. And how do we just navigate it together? And what is our North Star? Where are we all leading towards? And if we can kind of think of it outside of ourselves, that we're doing this not only just for the transaction of for our livelihood and the money. It's not only that, of course, it's important to have value for your work and contribution, but collectively, we're all going to work towards finding an answer to these yeah. problems or finding opportunity that's actually going to have an impact beyond even just this small community of the consultant and client team. So that's definitely a part of it. And I'm fortunate enough that all of the work that we do is really about making things better in the world.
And that's what it's about. That's what we're all here for, is to leave that impact, to leave the world a better place the way we found it, and to have an impact with people and make change in the world.
I mean, that's certainly one of my mantras. I don't know if it's everyone's.
No,
right?
I don't think so.
Yeah, and it's okay. Everybody yep. has different mantras and guiding forces. But for me, it's just always been that way. I've always looked at the world from a perspective of, it could probably be a little bit better, or I'm really curious why this is this way. Can we make a shift? It's always the puzzle pieces that I'm attracted to, wanting to figure out. And then yeah. when I'm in the middle of it, I think, why am I doing this?
Well, I think the key is to surround yourself with those people who are of like mind, that want to see a change and make a change in the world. And like you said, it's not for everybody, and that's okay. You stay in your lane, I'll stay in mine, and I'll find my people that will join me in my lane. And that's how we get shit done.
Yeah, I'm a huge believer in that, in aligning with the right people. And even when I think about fundraising or sales, it's about alignment. It's not yeah. about action, right? If we are in agreement that we have the same core values and interest in that North Star that I talked about before,
yeah.
then that feels a lot better. Even when you're asking someone to contribute to a cause or an initiative, a lot of people have trouble with solicitations. And fundraising. And a lot of it has to do with our relationship with money and
yes.
value and worth. And I remember Paulo Coelho in his book, Aleph, and he's really fabulous at writing fables that apply to our life. And there was a small little story in there where he talked to one of his friends about the importance of asking and giving. And we're normally much more comfortable with giving.
Yes, absolutely.
Right? Because it's a hierarchical position, like, I can give to this
yeah.
person, give to this, and it yes. makes me feel really great. Yes. Even people report themselves when they do it, or their names are on things, you
yeah.
know. Social cachet that comes with that, and acknowledgement and affirmation. And that's not a judgment, it's just a reality, right?
Yeah.
They're different drivers. But one of the things that has always stuck with me because it resonated was one of the reasons people do not want to ask is because subconsciously they have a judgment on the people who are asking them. And so they don't want to put themselves in that position. And so it's really important just from a human psyche to develop as a human being and evolve. Yeah. To consistently have that 360. So you need to be the person who's asking and the person who's giving, asking and giving consistently. Yeah. And when it comes to philanthropy, if we could step aside from our old belief systems around that value and worth and transactional nature, you're not really asking someone to give you a gift. Yeah. You're not asking someone to do a favor for you. You're asking someone to invest in something that's greater than themselves and you. And if we kind of look at it from that perspective and that lens, why wouldn't you want to be a part of that conversation? But there's not a lot of training around that in a different perspective. So I think both of those are really important
for sure.
To explore, and it helps us. When I thought about that and reading his book, I thought, wow, that's really a great perspective. And it really helps me understand there. I need to ask more.
Well, our conditioning ties into that quite a bit because we've been conditioned that asking for something or asking for help or whatever that may be is a sign of weakness.
Yeah.
You should be able to do it yourself. And honestly, I'm of the belief that not asking for help is a sign of weakness. I think asking for help is a sign of strength. And you have to be able to ask and receive in order to keep that cycle of giving going. You have to. And that's a lesson I've learned lately is that you have to be able to receive, because if not, you can't keep that cycle going.
And you can't really, I mean, part of it's good because you're bringing people in to be a part of something. But then on the other side of it, we only know what we know. And so the more people that we have really help to enrich that knowledge base and that core nucleus. And it just alleviates a lot of the pressures. I used to have a little sticker that said, you can do anything, but you don't have to do everything.
Yes.
And so sometimes we're over independent and don't realize that you actually do need to just let go just for the exercise of letting.
Well, also, it opens up the lanes for others to come in and do what they need to do and what their job is. So you're not only relieving or helping yourself, but you're also helping others by doing that, because that's letting them step into their area of expertise or their lane. You're opening things up for other people.
Right. I always say for my company, PS314, it is an exercise in building teams. And when I was a professor, the first half of the semester was all about the individual student. Tell me about you, tell me about your dreams, pitch something that's really important to you, do a SWOT analysis on yourself so you can understand who you really are. The second half was about teamwork. It's always interesting to watch undergraduates manage teams. And inevitably, there was always a team, if not more, where some people just didn't pull as much weight, right? How do you navigate getting to the end? Do you take on all of it? Do you communicate with others? What leverage do you use to ensure that things are going to happen? But there is a really great opportunity because you can also bring people in, not only to learn from, but they're also learning, right? Like I mentioned, I was talking to one of my consultants yesterday and I said, and I could see her just light up this new project. And I said, I think you're in your green space. And she said, what does that mean? I said, I think you found the lane that you love and you're really good at. And that's joy. If
that
you can do it and be paid for it at the same time and it has purpose.
It's like winning the lottery twice. That's what I compare it to, is finding your purpose, your passion, your lane, and also having that work that you do impact and give back to others. That's winning the lottery twice in my books, for sure. Can you share with us what you were doing for a living before you made the jump into entrepreneurship and started PS314? And what was the catalyst for that shift?
I started this company about 9 years ago, 2015, because the company didn't exist. There wasn't a company like this, and I needed one when I was an impact producer working on documentary films. But I also had an independent consulting practice beginning in 2005. So 10 years prior to that, I left a really huge consulting agency. It was global. I worked 80% of the time, traveled quite a bit. And the lifestyle wasn't one that I really wanted, but I'd gone out on my own and thought, well, I know how to be a consultant. And that's what I did. Sometimes I'd hire people to work with me and sometimes I didn't. And I always worked on humanitarian causes and it was always in the nonprofit arena. And on a parallel track, I went to film school. And when I finished film school, I realized that there was a creative way to do this critical thinking, very important, heavy work around social justice too, that we could merge in some way. But I was looking at artists, like, how can I help artists? And so I started working with documentary filmmakers and helping them raise money and awareness. And it worked really well. I wasn't always in their budget. So it was the same fee that I would get from a nonprofit. So I was like, how do I make this work and do work that's really creative? And so I thought, well, maybe I can kind of figure it out on the side while I have a job working for a foundation. But right. It took a lot of my time. So then I went to work at a small boutique consulting agency, and I thought, maybe I'll build it inside. But if you're not the visionary, you're not building anything inside. Nope. Nelson's company. And I remember distinctly, I was sitting across from someone I admire very much, who is a really great visionary and entrepreneur. I love his work and his company's work, and they do a lot of social change. And I was talking to him a little bit about the vision I had for the work I was doing kind of on the side, this model of building social change campaigns and bringing everyone together, not only in the nonprofit, but in the for-profit community, being able to serve artists and entrepreneurs, thinking about storytelling, thinking about philanthropy, thinking about capacity and leadership development. And he said, do you want to work here? And I just looked at him with a blank stare. He asked me 5 years before, I've been like, yeah, I totally want to work for you. Yeah. 2 years even before. He said, okay, forget it. You don't want to work here.
Your face says it all.
And I said, I just think I have to try. I think I have to build this thing, because when I was a filmmaker, I needed a place that I could bring my film and say, okay, help me build this. And how do I make this thing do good and do well? And there was not one place who understood the importance of ensuring that it could create revenue, but then also have an impact. There just was not one. And I looked everywhere and I could cobble it together, but it was very expensive. So he gave me two pieces of advice, and it really helped me in the first couple of years. He said, okay, don't do it alone. Get a partner. And the second one was, get your proof of concept. Don't worry about the money. And so I didn't really set the fee structure, I think, until like year two. And I called a friend of mine, and who was also kind of in the field of philanthropy, who was a creative. She is a writer. And I trusted her. She is a beautiful spirit. And I said, don't you want to come do this with me? And she said, no, I do not want to partner with you to build a business, but I will do some project with you. And she was with me for 7.5 years. And she really helped me build this, because what she could see in a meeting was different than what I could see.
Yeah.
She could see in people was different from what I could see. Mm-hmm. And she's now off thriving, running an advancement department of a major museum. And I support her and love her dearly. And I'm so thankful, because that one person that came on board was the beginning of 50 other consultants.
Wow.
And then we had a whole operations team. And so I was kind of learning it, and gave me the bandwidth. And then when I didn't have to think about, of course, you want to think about money, but I scaled down my life. I paid off all my debts. I brought my lifestyle down to a very small number. I mean, there was like nothing happening but me going to the gym and working. Probably the first 4 years of the company. Yeah, I just didn't even, I mean, I started to socialize a little bit more in year three, but I was a little awkward, honestly. I threw a party and I was like, how do we do this again? I don't remember. And then COVID hit year five. And we had just kind of gotten over that. We were trying to make money and things were in place, and I was planning on taking the company on the road, because our clients and consultants were all over the country, and we got the phone calls from some of our clients saying, I don't think we should do this in-person meeting, and it got quiet. And it was every year we increased our revenue. That year we were back down to our revenue from year 1.5, 2, and I didn't know if we were going to survive. I had to continuously put my own money back into the company, not pay myself. I paid the consultants. I didn't pay myself for a while, actually. But I just believed in it. I wanted it to stay. I wanted it to be here, not only just for me, but just for the consistency of having a place. And I found that a lot of our consultants and clients felt at home there. So we would have conversations. I have a few that are on YouTube around identity, because what we saw was there's a lack of understanding of each other. We're working with a lot of people and we're leaning in, and all of the people who work in the company are all really different. And so that was natural to me. But what you find when we have these uprisings and when we have so much violence and injustice in the world that continues to perpetuate, there's a lack of understanding that exists. We're believing a narrative that fits our particular reality, but there are many realities that
absolutely
exist. Opening it up to just listening and understanding someone else's, I think, is really important. So that's what we were seeking to do that year.
That's the key, is the listening part of it. We always, and when I say listen, I mean really listen to what someone's saying, not listening so that you can respond, because that's what a lot of people do, is they're listening, but they're already formulating what they're going to say next or how they're going to come back with something to say about what that person's saying, instead of actually listening, taking it all in, processing, and then responding.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, the conversation, and I can't agree with you more. I'm so not the person who goes to a networking event or a reception or a gala and does small talk. I usually start with the weather, as we did earlier.
Yes.
Because I'm obsessed with the sun and the sea. But then I go right into, so what do you think about this?
Get right into it.
What do you do for a living and do you love it? And it's funny because I know that some people feel a little uncomfortable when someone asks, what do you do? And I think it's because traditionally or in some groups, that means that I'm sizing you up. You know, what do you do?
Yeah.
For me, I just want to cuddle up on the couch and have a snack and a cup of tea. And I want to talk to you about, are you in your green space? Mm-hmm. And if so, like, how'd you get there? Like, what you need to really understand the human experience, because it's different from mine.
Yeah, I love hearing people's stories and how they got to where they are. That, to me, is interesting. That's conversation.
You can learn so much. Yeah. I listened to Matthew McConaughey's book, and I was not expecting it to be as powerful.
I love that book.
It was so good.
It was amazing.
Yeah. So I agree, but I do wonder a little bit. I love the fact that we are connected. There are no geographical boundaries because of our virtual space, but I feel that because things are moving so quickly online, and we don't often have quiet times to connect, and there may be some of those skills that aren't being developed or we're losing.
Agreed.
So that muscle should be constantly charged
worked.
Up.
Yeah, for sure. What personal experiences or values inspired you to become a philanthropist and advocate for social justice? And how long have you been doing this work?
My whole life. I mean, we talked before, I told you about what happened when I was 14. And so that was the beginning for me in terms of the activation of being supportive. But injustice and equity, I think, was around me for a while. So when I was 14 years old, I had an opportunity to go work with my mom. She's a producer, and she's really an activist, but producer is her title. And she has a really amazing career that she's kind of carved out on her own. So I've always been learning from her. And this particular summer, I was going into the theater that she was running at the time, and I was just working either in the office or as an usher, or she'd throw me out onto the stage to give flowers. I don't have a lot of stage fright often. We were coming home. This theater was in Brooklyn, but we lived in Long Island. That's really where I was my teenage years. And we were driving in her car. And what I was sharing with you is that my biggest issues at the time were Paula Abdul or Janet Jackson. Who do I go with?
Yeah. You know?
We have two. We don't always have many at the time. And I was a Paula Abdul girl. I love Janet. I was really like, forever your girl. That's it. I know I was the first of that song. I was singing along in the Air Force song. We're in our Honda Prelude 87 and we're driving on Knock and Do It. And I got a corner of my eye. I see this guy and he's so cute. Like, he looks like the kind of guy that I would be attracted to. It's like my age and everything about him. It just stopped me. And I looked, and then I looked again, and it was really hot. It's August. So muggy in New York, and he's sweating. But I know that he's sweating because he only has on shorts, like nothing else. But his body looks emaciated, like not in a cool way of like putting the shorts on. And he's asking for help. And it was the first time I'd seen anyone in that position who looked like me and who was like me. Right. It wasn't on TV. It wasn't like someone who's much older who's sitting on a stoop or on the side of the street, and you kind of pass by, you somewhat ignore it because in New York, you kind of have to have your blinders on. You go where you go. And I had a visceral reaction. I was hot. I felt the heat that he felt. It was like the tears welled up in my eyes. And by the time I got home, I was just in tears with my mom. And I was asking her, I don't understand. Why is this the situation for him? And my reality was middle-class life in the suburbs, going to this beautiful school that was in a state out in Long Island. And all my friends and family lived in my neighborhood. And everyone was different, but sort of the same.
Yeah.
And life was Paula Abdul and Janet Jackson. And in that moment, my little world, that reality, that bubble burst, and it now included him. How do you make sense of that? And I begged her to take my little check from the summer and find him and give it to him. So I'd ask her all the time. She'd come home from work in the fall when I went back to school. And by the winter, she said, I saw him. And she'd pick my check inside of the glove department. How she signed it over is beyond me when I think about it. But oh, did you give him the check? And she said, no. And my mother's older and she grew up in New York. So she might have been like, I don't know if he was really needing help because he seemed okay. And he was with friends. And she said, so I think he's okay, but let's find another way for you to help. And that was kind of my inquiry into the world. How can I help? And it came from inside of me. And I felt that in different places. And that's kind of how I feel fortunate that every job I've ever had, every position I've ever held, whether it's volunteer or paid, has been for a cause for the greater good.
Love it. I love that story. It's so powerful because to have the self-awareness at that age, mm-hmm. to notice someone, because, I mean, even you see adults walking down the streets who just walk past people that are in that type of position and just keep going, don't even pay attention. But as a teenager, teenagers are usually quite wrapped up in themselves, let's be honest. Absolutely. But to have the self-awareness to notice something like that, I think speaks to who you are as a woman, as a human, and as a person. So I admire your self-awareness and the thoughts to do something, to want to do something at that young age, I think is pretty incredible.
Thank you. It reminds me, I'd gone to South Africa right after I graduated from college in 97. It was a couple of years after apartheid ended. Stayed with a family, a philanthropist who was like a family friend, asked if I would go. Well, my cousin and I had gone. He was from Zimbabwe and he wanted to know what's the best business I should start there now that we can. And he arranged for us to stay with a family that had just moved out of the township. It's a black family. And I was very excited. I'd never been to Africa. And so I thought, I'm going home. And I get off of the plane and the family's there. And they said, oh, I thought you're going to be black. And my background and my family is, my mother's side, it's Italian and Asian. My grandfather's from my grandmother's from Italy. On my father's side, they're from the South, actually African-American primarily. And I think actually just all the way through to Africa, no stops along the way. And so my cousin actually is much more fair than I am. She has more Native American in her. And right. So she was considered to be white and I was considered to be colored. And can you imagine right after apartheid where no groups were ever come together, mm-hmm. we were living in Durban, which is more of a rural community. So we were stared at all the time. But I was heartbroken. I was like, wait, I am black. What do you mean?
Yeah.
First time that I realized that your identity, it has so much, of course, it's who you choose to be. And a lot of it has to do with what you've been born into. And it's about a month and a half walking through the township, another episode of my visceral reaction. I loved going to visit because we were just going to visit their friends. It was like going to another neighborhood. You could see it was on a mountain. You could see there was only one entrance and exit. You could see that it had not been built out for population growth. So it was like up the mountainside, you'd have small little shacks of families that would run the wires so that they could have electricity. You'd see the dorms that there was no plumbing done, and so the pipes had burst and were on the side. I mean, you could see some of the issues and disparities, but we're still just going to visit. And I was walking through the neighborhood with some of our family and friends that were there, and I started to cry. And my cousin said, what's the matter? What's wrong? And I looked at her and I said, the only reason that they're here is because they're black. It had just occurred to me how different our lives were. So for them, we weren't black. This was just, and we were American. But in addition to that, you can, again, be in your bubble, an American bubble, yep. in New York, in middle class, as an African American, and just think that's the only reality. But it literally was turned on its head. And it just started to open me up to other realities. So I'm always seeking them.
How do you define social justice? And in your perspective, what are the critical components necessary for achieving a just society?
I wonder, especially I remember in 2020 when everything happened in the summer and there were so many marches and there were many deaths, many indignities that had continued on. And the film that kind of sparked my interest in building my company, that's where I built the social change campaign model. Yeah. It was about race in America. And the way that we structured the tour was to identify different markets that we would go to around the country. We decided on 7. Mm-hmm. And they were all really different. And the film is focused on hate crimes. Okay. It's about race.
Yeah.
But what I love about the title is that it opens the doors up for everyone to identify with it because you understand what it means to be exposed to have been a part of or been a victim of a crime that was driven by hate. Mm. Race may not be your first reality.
Yeah.
Gender might be, or region might be, or religion, or sexual orientation, or gender identity, whatever it happens to be, ability. There's so many different, and they're layered. But for us, when we went on the tour, what we did was we looked at those communities and said, okay, so what are the core issues as it relates to hate, and how do we bring those conversations to bear while still talking about race? Mm-hmm. And so when you can bring in a conversation about religious identity in Cincinnati and in Kentucky, where it was Jewish and Muslim communities that had a lot of friction between them and wanted to talk a lot about the various hate crimes that had taken place on both sides, then there was an understanding. And then when you show the film, there's an even greater understanding than for folks who have an opening. And so when I think about social justice, I looked it up the other day. I looked up justice and equity. Justice is about changing systems and practices and policies so that you can create greater equity in society. And when we think about equity, it's about understanding why have things not been equitable and equal. Mm-hmm. And you can't just move it into, okay, everybody gets the same thing.
No.
So I used to be a teacher. Standardized tests don't work because we don't all enter this from the same space.
Yeah.
So third grade's a huge marker. And I worked as a fifth grade teacher. Well, in third grade or even in fifth grade, those students are not all up to fifth grade level when they arrive.
Yeah.
They weren't up to fourth grade level.
Wow.
For various reasons. By the way, summer ahead. Summer at sixth grade level. It's just various circumstances. Sometimes there is choices, but there's a lot of circumstances that come into play. And it has a lot to do with the inequities that are kind of baked into our country and our world and the system that is focused as the first identity as a transactional capitalist society. And for it to be capitalistic, you have to have a top that is very small, a bottom that's very large, and you have various systems that support it. So when I remember when things changed for me, when I started to really think about justice and equity, away from just diversity and inclusion and broaden the conversation, I was on a panel and the question was, how do you diversify your board of directors? And for a while, I was starting diversity initiatives in companies and would go and do lectures on it. And I'd say, well, for the Black community, for these religious communities, I do all my research. And it was the first time that I changed my perspective on it. And what I offered was, there are lots of steps on how to diversify, but that's not actually where you start. Where you start is by asking yourselves why it hasn't been diverse. You have to address the root. You have to address the complacency in that and the comfort.
There we go.
The comfort in having everyone who maybe feels the same, has the same perspective. And what does diversity look like for you? If you can start to kind of interrogate that and pull it up and address it and own it and have that agency and say, okay, so we need to change X, Y, and Z. Own the space of what your North Star is, not for me to decide for you, and then work towards it. If you don't do that work, what happens is when you're inviting people in who are different than what has always been, the work and labor of change belongs to them, which is completely unfair. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of what we see. We see a lot folks who are doing the work who also represent the work, and they're not fully compensated or acknowledged or valued for it. And then we have observers. And so what we all need to do is actually get on the stage together.
There you go.
Together and start to excavate and do a lot of it. So justice to me is about really exploring the why first and then thinking through the how we can make it better. And we will eventually, I think, get a little bit closer. I don't know if in my lifetime things will change because there are power dynamics that exist. So that's why I always say you can do good and you can do well at the same time. You don't have to remove having a great livelihood, whatever that looks like for you.
There's a lot of work to do. We have a long way to go. But if we each chip in and do our part and come together as a collective, we're going to get shit done quicker. It's going to move faster, and our voices are louder when we are collectively working together. That's how you start change. So we need to come together.
I think so. There's a group called Coming Together, and they're one of the partners we had in the film, and I learned a lot from them. A lot of times with the partners, I try to live it too. So it's basically, it was created by cousins who learned they were cousins because they came from the same plantation. And there was a documentary done about them when they drove cross country together to learn more about each other. And what they realized was they needed to have the conversations as uncomfortable as they were. And so they created a program around it. And what was interesting was there were very specific rules that were in play. So for example, when there was a topic around that was foregrounding race and people of color, and I was mostly Black and white, Black folks were asked to speak first to honor the experience because it's your lived experience.
Yeah.
And if we're talking about race and racial injustice and racial violence, if it's not your lived experience, you have to make space for that.
For sure.
Accommodations came in. I think that working together is accurate. And I think that there are many different identities that we have to bring into the world. And we don't center one. It's really just about everyone can be there. I also feel we have to ensure their safety.
Yes.
And there's been a lot of harm. And so what does it mean to even get to the place where we could sit at the table together and we have trust? What does it mean to be able to work through your own in your particular community? Because there are so many fractures, and mm-hmm. not just about being Black or being white or being from Canada or being from America or being of a particular social class. There's so many intersections that I agree we should be working together. But I also think that we have to understand ourselves and we have to understand each other.
100%.
And respect both and find ways that honor and give grace.
Absolutely. I know. I think back to when I was a kid and growing up in Toronto and the neighborhood, and we as kids, we didn't see color or race. We just, hey, you're my friend. I don't care what color. We were colorblind. We didn't see it that way. And of course, living in North America, growing up in North America, having a very privileged compared to some other people's lives and how they were raised and how they were brought up and what they had to go through and deal with, keeping that in mind. But we just didn't see things that way. And I think it's horrible that we are where we are with all of this shit, what's gone on between races. And kids are not born racist. I don't care what anybody, a child does not come into the world racist. That is a learned behavior. And we need to change that. That's ridiculous. But growing up in the way I was brought up, that's just who we were. That's, we hung out with everybody. It didn't matter what race you were, what color you were. That had no bearing whatsoever.
I think that I remember you sharing that with me, and I can completely, it resonates. I remember being seven or 8 years old and coming home and asking my mother if my grandmother was white, because one of the kids in the neighborhood told me she was. And as far as I knew, she was Italian, and that wasn't color. And my family is a mixture of something. I'm one of the darker members of my family on my mother's side, right? Lighter on my father's side, and mixed bag with my friends. So that was the first time that I kind of connected color with my life. And my mother was just so amazingly brilliant in her approach to parenting me, because her response before she said yes or no, she asked me, what would be the difference if she were white? And she really challenged me to be human and connect. I love my grandma. I was very close to her. She's no longer with us. But what's interesting is, I think what happens is, I agree, we aren't born this way, but we're nurtured based on our experiences and the circumstances and the choices, right? Like, I'm born here in America, and our friends in South Africa are born there, and by the same color, it's a different experience.
Yeah.
So then it's front and center. I think that you start to notice things when you're the only one sometimes in the room. Mm-hmm. Or when everyone is exactly like you and you're here and you're not someplace else.
Yeah.
You start to find and feel the injustices. I remember I was told, I staged a walkout in my high school at 14 after the Rodney King verdict because I was up in arms because I watched it. I remember reading Malcolm X's book in high school, and I remember watching Rodney King get beat up by the cops, and my uncles were cops, and it didn't make sense to me. So constantly my brain is exploding.
Yeah.
And the reality of safety are just being broken, and it fractures the trust that you have in communities, right?
Yeah, for sure.
And so when you start to see some of the same people in certain positions, and there's a pattern of behavior, or there are certain policies in place, that's also part of what nurtures your understanding of the world. And for some of us, you can't escape that.
Yeah.
And for some of us, we can choose to walk into it or walk out of it.
Very true.
And a lot of it does have to do with our identities. I mean, I'm an able-bodied person. Mm-hmm. When it rains, I can hold a umbrella. My life is not connected to not having full capacity of my body in this moment. So I don't know what that means for someone who's disabled, who's in New York, where 70% of the trains do not have working elevators. Like, what does that mean?
Yeah.
And so I think that for so many of us, we have different realities, and it's something that we have to be mindful that, in my mind, we should be leaning in a little bit more to the ones that we don't live in.
Yep.
So we can understand each other instead of judging each other and find greater compassion. I don't think we're meant to live in these little silos and fiefdoms of comfort all the time. And I agree with you, what you said earlier. There should be some level of impact. It doesn't have to be global.
No.
It could just be in your own body of just kind of changing the way that you think and see things to make room for grace and understanding.
But that's where it all starts, though. That's where you have to start, is here within you. And then that goes outward into your communities. Keep it in the local communities, then society, then it builds and builds and builds and spreads and brings more and more people in. But you have to start here for sure. And then at a community level, grassroots level, and then it just goes, it flows out from there. That's the way to start. Social justice is a global concern. How do you contribute to social change on a global scale? And how does your philanthropy address interconnected issues across borders?
So I live and work intersectionally. So I really do embrace all of my identities. And I've been fortunate enough to have so many different experiences working at various levels of society that I really bring that to bear in conversations. And I also bring that to bear with my networks. And I try to bring as many people in as possible. So I know that many of our systems are built as a triangle. And we have lots of folks who are at the top.
Oh, yes.
And we have lots of folks who are living and doing a lot of the work. We're being impacted by a lot of the policies that trickle down at the quote-unquote bottom. And so I wake up every day and I work against it. I work against the triangle and I build a circle. Literally everything that you see is about a circle. And it's just about shifting the perspective. So in terms of a global impact, our clients are operating and the work that they're doing go beyond borders. So I know that for sure. The consultants as well don't all live here in America. But in addition to that, everyone also brings with them various perspectives, cultural perspectives, whether that is through their living and personal travels or their work travels. It kind of all comes together. Sometimes our clients are global and sometimes they're extremely regional. And what I love about the collective within my company is that it's non-hierarchical. So we really do believe that sometimes our clients will become our consultants, they'll become our advisors, look more about this work, and so help us with this learning curve. And the same is true for some of our consultants who are not only experts in design thinking, but also artists in their own right, and they need help to kind of lift them off of the ground to build out something that they have an interest in. But I also, because I have worked, my first job was working for Vice President Gore when he was at the White House, and it's a very high pressure position at 22. And you learn a lot about power and global impact.
I'm sure you do.
My boss used to put me in the room with them all the time and just stand there for a while. Gore thought I was the Secret Service, maybe the youngest one with a nose ring, but just stand there. And I learned so much that I'm just soaking it up. And you never get an opportunity to just be in the room and not have the responsibility of doing something. But my job right after that was being a public school teacher in Washington, D.C., bilingual special ed, fifth grade ESL. And so I think of that as grass tops, grassroots. Mm-hmm. We talked about education policy. I had talking points whenever I was on the road that went along with what they decided it was. But because it was coming out of my mouth, there's an assumption that, okay, young Black woman also believes that too. But that was my job.
Yeah.
If I'd been in that particular reality and bubble, that would have consistently been my politics. Mm-hmm. So I understand when I listen to different folks who work in politics or on behalf of it, if that is their world, that is also their politics. But I went and lived my politics. I went to a classroom to understand what economics and race and immigration policy and healthcare and standardized tests do to children. Households that don't necessarily have significant income and resources, where one parent's working in the daytime, the other one's in the evening, and the child has lead poisoning because that's part of the paint, that's where they could live, and that's why they're acting up that day. Or another one who is asleep in my class because the shelter won't open until 1 a.m. and it's about, you know, many miles away and 2 bus zones. And so they need rest. And when the power went out in D.C., I'd make a deal with the janitor to give me all of the food so I can go over. I knew my kids weren't eating and they needed the food. So I think that, and those are extra steps, right?
Yeah.
But each of these experiences for me, film school, being challenged by how do I communicate with this community who does not connect to race as that identity. We can connect with religion, make room for that. There's a bridge. Art can help us with that as a tool for change, because you can't unsee that. You can't unfeel it. It stays with you. It changes your nervous system in a way. I look for ways to shift the kaleidoscope. And I do it based on the experiences that I've had. And I bring different people into rooms together, or I bring myself modeling an experience that is not present there. Yeah. So for a while it was, I was the only one who was of my race, my generation, my gender. And now it's like, I'm going to speak on behalf of what I think is happening in politics at the White House, because I've been there. I'm going to speak on behalf of being an independent artist, because I have been there. I'm going to speak on behalf of being a Black woman entrepreneur, because I've been there, right?
You've lived experience.
Completely. And the more that we can kind of bring all of that together, that's why I love the teams. I love the intergenerational nature. I love the fact that everyone's so diverse in every aspect of the word that comes together in our consultant teams. It's not just, do you know philanthropy? Do you know strategy? It's also, what perspective are you going to bring to this that's going to be, that we can all learn from, and it's going to be really rich. And then it's almost like a practice in equity is the work that we're doing as we're helping each other kind of get to that North Star.
Now, of course, we've talked about it. It's collaboration, community. These are the keys. They are the foundation for everything, absolutely everything. We cannot get by in life without those two pieces. We need them. Collaboration is key to social change. So how do you build collaborative partnerships with other philanthropists, organizations, and communities to amplify your impact?
I look for the alignment. I really try to understand and listen, as you mentioned, to really what the goals are and the core values and where we are aligned. What is it that you really are seeking to do? What are you struggling with? What are your pain points? How can we be of help to you? We work with philanthropist individuals. We also work with major foundations, and sometimes they're smaller ones, but they're always blind spots. There's always something there that needs a little bit of tweaking.
Yeah.
Can really help, especially now. It's a weird time. I thought we'd have a 5-year run at equity. It's only turned out to be 3. So now it's a slippery mountain slope. And there are some folks who are just continuously doing the work and saying, I'm going to go into overdrive on this.
Yeah.
And we're more than happy to be in service to that work. And then there are others who are really concerned about, look, these aren't the priorities of my company any longer. But how do I integrate the core values? And so, again, inviting everyone to be a part of a roundtable discussion and building collaborative models for working together and understanding that everyone should be different. It's helped me in building my teams to build collaboration with our clients. And then I do this on behalf of the clients and working within their communities. I do that personally as well. And I didn't realize I was doing it. I think it was simply because I was so excited about learning more. I've had amazing mentors. They become our strategic advisors. So they can mentor many of our consultants and our clients and give access to different spaces. But I think sometimes what happens is there's entitlement and resentment that gets in the way of collaboration and community.
For sure.
Because of real things that happen, and also because of assumptions and a lack of understanding. And so the bridge is trust and transparency and authenticity. And I always say I have built a company that is human-centered, which means that at the beginning and at the end and throughout, I'm thinking about the people. Yeah, we're doing work, but you know, if you're going through a divorce, if you are lost a parent, if you're not well, there's still space for you here. You're not a robot. And so maybe take a breath. Maybe change it up a little bit. I need to give a little bit more grace. We all have to give more grace. Don't bring your assumptions to the table. And I demand that on both sides. So that's how I do it in the work that I do.
I love it. Now, you've mentioned art a couple of times throughout the conversation. And of course, speak to your experience as an artist. You are a photographer, and your work that you have done in the arts community specifically, art and creativity are very powerful tools for social change. How do you support and amplify the work of marginalized artists and creators through your philanthropy?
I think it's just a natural space. So the entry point to work with PS314 is I am working on an initiative, a program. The work that we do is all about equity. If I can't find it in your work, then we're probably not the best team for you, because that's the North Star that we're all leading towards. And inevitably, our clients are either representing marginalized communities or vulnerable communities as their own lived experience or the work that they're doing is in support of. And sometimes it's both. So that's not a hard thing to get to. That's the nature of the work and the people that are attracted to and in alignment with. In addition to that, I find that's truly the case when it comes to the consultants as well. There's a space that is a part of their own identity, whether it's something that's been chosen or circumstantial, that they really do resonate with being closer to that.
Yeah.
So it's the grassroots to grass top space. And I think that depending on who we're talking to, if we have folks, and again, everyone is really important and has a space here, but if we're talking to folks who have significant power at the top of that pyramid, let's just say,
or maybe triangle,
right? Or moving our clients to the top of the space. For us, sometimes it's about giving a perspective to those who are in power who maybe not, who are not necessarily the practitioners. They are in powerful positions and can change policy and programs, but we have to shift. And I find that art is a beautiful tool for change. And I mentioned it before, because you can't unsee it, you can't unhear it, you can't unread it, it's with you. And it's part of an experience that you'll have. I mean, we are connecting many of our consultants and clients with the powers that be in their particular arena. We'll provide them with new plans in terms of marketing to really amplify their work. But a lot of it has to do with, let's align with who is it that is being impacted. Let's identify who's interested and invested in your work. Build out your ecosystem. Stay true there. And then the amplification can be defined in so many different ways. It's not just about the views or how many people. It could simply be more about a depth as opposed to a breadth. We really want to think through your capacity, what's your goal, and then how do we kind of build that out. But as long as it's authentic to their goal, they'll reach it. We had one client, and they were with us for 4.5 years doing different types of work. And I remember at the time, the executive director was just so frustrated. I don't know if I can continue on. I don't know if this organization is going to continue on. We have so many others we're in competition with who are at the top. And I would talk about them as the 40-year startup. They're 40 years old. They were doing amazing work. They'd given a boost to so many artists of color. But sometimes when you're doing that, you feel as though you're at the bottom. You're getting just like constant everything. And how can you constantly hold it up? And so a shifting of the paradigm a bit and bringing them to the leaders in the field, but doing it in a way that highlights who they really are. From another perspective, it's not so much about we've done all this work to help these people, but instead, what is all of that meant that you are actually a thought leader in space and you can speak from all these perspectives. And now they're at the top and they're thriving. When we tend to say to artists sometimes, when you get this fellowship, we're done. When you are in the New York Times, we're finished. When you hit this particular marker, then you can thrive. And what's interesting is I remember before I started this company, when I was just doing independent practice, my sister and I were working together. And we went into a meeting with a very large client, very powerful client. And we walked out and I said, well, nothing happened on that agenda that I thought. And she said, no, I think something else is happening here. We do have a therapist sometimes in our room so that we can understand the human dynamics. Like, is this a power play? And so we have always some type of a coach who's a part of the work that we do. It helps us understand who we are and how we're communicating, but it also helps us understand the humans, especially vulnerable communities, disenfranchised communities. There's a lot of pain sometimes because we've been unseen, because we've not been heard, we haven't been given opportunities or access. And so really wanting to unpack that a little bit and not thrust folks into a space where they're not prepared. For like sure. A lot too. So that's part of it.
Now, of course, empathy, this is a great segue into this. Empathy is foundational to understanding and addressing social issues. So how do you cultivate and apply empathy in your philanthropic work? And how does it shape your decision making?
Well, I mean, I think grace is critically important. So whenever we're working on a program or initiative or a project that is explicitly about equity, and it's about the humans doing the work around equity, we don't bring in an idea of what that means. So because it's not our space. We come in with lots of great skills and expertise. We're here to provide you a safe space to interrogate, to excavate, and then to define what your North Star is based on where you start. So I go back to the standardized test. We're not all at the third grade level.
No.
We don't all have the same lived experience. We don't have the same understanding. We don't have the same compassion points. right? We're all very different. We all live by various values. The first thing that we have to do is define what the core values are that we all believe in. That's going to keep us honest and together. We start to build community. Then we have to start to experiment with that work a little bit to just kind of see where the safeguards need to be to ensure that it is a trusted space, and then allow folks to really define for themselves what has been inequity. Where are your pain points? What are you struggling towards? Why are you here? What is it that you'd really like to achieve realistically? Not to solve necessarily, but to address. What do you feel together you can put in place that's going to make this a little bit better? It's going to stretch you beyond where you are. That to me is about empathy, because we're practicing, we're modeling a behavior that's going to bring compassion, but also a lot of grace, because we're not all the same. And inevitably, there are different power dynamics. I think sometimes we think that one group has all the power and another doesn't. And that's not true. It depends on the circumstances.
Sure.
When I was teaching, I remember one of my first classes, I was trying to explain equity and social change to my students who had no idea anything about charity or nonprofits and did not think nonprofits were businesses, but they thought they were hobbies to give money to sometimes. And that's what their mothers did. This is a very diverse class that I had in terms of color and gender. And these are my students. So I said, well, let's just explore education and economic justice and equity. And let's make this $70,000 school per year tuition go away and make it free. Completely accessible. And they said, no, thank you. And they said, no, thank you, because they were aligned on the social cachet of the tuition and what it meant to be from a school at that level. It's not for me to judge them on that.
No.
But it is for me to be clear on what that actually means. So that is a velvet rope that you have decided needs to be there that creates a lack of access for some people. And that is your choice. And these are the implications of that. And this is what you are all connected to. You're different in many ways, but you're the same here. Inevitably, in your life, you will be on the other side because of an identity that is different. Inevitably. And so the work around empathy and understanding is to be on both sides and understand what it means when you then have not had an opportunity to have power. What does that mean? What happens to many folks who were given power and opportunity and access in South Africa after apartheid ended? Did all the doors open? We're a small little few. Do we have that here as well in every society? What are the core values that we're operating on, and what are our North Stars?
Yeah.
So for me, it always comes down to, let's do good. Let's do well, but let's do good. And we can do that at the same time, but we have to be mindful and give grace to everyone and make decisions that we can be fully accountable for.
How do you envision the evolving role of philanthropy in society, and what aspirations do you have for the impact of the philanthropic work in the future?
I love Edgar Villanueva's work, Decolonizing Wealth and Philanthropy. He's just interrogating it all. And I love it. He's really kind of thinking about how do we understand this from a space of power and practice and bring everyone to the same table and just have a better understanding. And it takes a lot to do. When I entered into a space of lectures around philanthropy, I looked it up. And philanthropy actually means for the love of humanity. It is not about writing a check. It isn't. And sometimes you'll hear people say your talent, your treasure, your time. And it really is about giving of service to something greater than yourself, to support the good, to do good in the world, right? And sometimes that is about money. Sometimes that's about your time. And other times it's about your talent. I've been fortunate to combine all three in everything that I'm doing. And because I'm combining them and I embrace all of my lived experiences, what I model without even knowing that I do it, but with deep intention, is one that considers as many people as possible, as many different people as possible. And that I do not create a hierarchy for those who are exhibiting philanthropy simply through financial resources. I honor those who are volunteering. I honor those who have a perspective that is needed at the table. Everyone needs to be there. And I think that there are doors that are starting to be open around that everywhere, by the way. And so we are to define philanthropy as doing good and being of service to our society so that we can all have access and opportunity for a good life. That's really what we want, to have safety and have a good life and stay towards that North Star. I believe we can start to chip away. And you start to see this with the new generations, really thinking about, I think I'd prefer to work this way. I think I'd prefer to have a more balanced life. I think that I would like to define success on my own terms. I think that I'd like to be bold and brazen to live my life authentically and live through this identity, which is more me, even if you don't see me as that. Mm-hmm. I think that gives us opportunity to just kind of break out of the mold of centering one idea of who we can be and living very boldly, that actually the pyramid does not exist.
It's a circle. I mean, really, isn't this the basics of what the human experience is? We're here to give back, to lift each other, to support each other, to cheerlead each other and help each other. Those are the basic necessities of life, why we're here, why we're living. So we are philanthropy. This is the way we should be living, period.
Right.
It's pretty simple when you think about it, when you break it down, it's a fairly simple concept. It really is. Just do good in your life to help others, period.
Yeah. And I think that we are in a world where we're programmed to think that we have many enemies and a big one inside of our heads. We're not good enough because we're not this person, or we haven't achieved enough, or we don't look this way, or we don't act a certain way, or we need to have I feel joy when I am powerful over someone else. Sure. So there's some work that we have to do. We're all indoctrinated into this society that's built and focused on elevating one type. I did a talk recently. I named it Systemic Addiction. And I talked about being an achievement addict. So I'm a recovering type A. And the recovering achievement addict. My father passed away a few years ago, suddenly. And I've always been an overdrive. As you mentioned, a million hats.
Yeah.
And I move fast. I move very fast. And I do a lot of work at one time, which is why I get to not always have a meeting before 10 or 11 and finish my 5 or 6. But you know, sometimes I got to work on the weekends and work 14, 15 hours. And I've always been able to move into that drive. And after he passed away, it was like one of my, like a three-legged stool, one of the legs were gone. And it took a while to settle into this new life without him. That's how grief works, where it's a new way of being. And what was really amazing about my dad was he came from a family of entrepreneurs and had quite a bit of so many different resources afforded to him. And he chose to be an activist. He chose to move away from being an actor and really fight for the Black Arts Movement at a very early age. And sometimes that meant that he had to sacrifice his own livelihood for a host of different reasons. I remember asking him once, do you enjoy your life, if you had a good life? And he said, I've had the best life. I've done so much. Mm. And I was surprised because in my mind, well, shouldn't you have a certain amount of money? And he's really, the affirmation is real.
Yeah. Oh, right? Yeah, for sure.
And he had some misogyny. So there was that too, right? Like when he had daughters, he started to learn a little bit more about giving grace and understanding. I share that with you though, because it shifted me a lot. And it made me take a step back to look at the world in a very different way and to live in a more present way. And I started to define my life in a more balanced way where I accept I've done all of this and I've learned a lot. I've done all of this and I've met a lot of people and they're real relationships and I can call on them, right? And they can call on me. But there are also times I'm going to say no. There are also times when I'm going to take a break. And I don't always ask that question anymore. How can I help? Because sometimes what that would translate into was me doing all the work. Because people were used to people who looked like me doing all the work. And so I even had to challenge that with myself. And what I came out of it with, and what I talked about in my talk, Systemic Addiction, was that sometimes when we live in this world that's indoctrinated and focused on this goal of reaching that very top, we sacrifice so much. And often we sacrifice ourselves because we don't realize that we have blinders on. Mm-hmm. Everyone else is the enemy if they don't co-sign and live in accordance with our values and what we've been told to believe in, that possibly these other people are taking something away from us.
Yeah.
These other realities don't exist. And I think intuitively our bodies know that that's not actually right. And so we have addictions that we live in. And sometimes that has to do with food. Sometimes that has to do with hate. And sometimes it has a variety of things that become tools of distraction and delusion. When we can break away from that and really see it for what it is. So for me, I dug into my work. That was my addiction. If I have all of the achievements, you can't tell me I don't belong here. I'm going to lead with my work so that you know that I'm a value and I'm a worth. And I didn't even know I was doing it because I was still a humanitarian.
Yeah.
But I'm still doing it because I live in this world that sometimes when people ask you, what do you do? It's because they're sizing you up.
As we said earlier.
So when my dad died, it slowed me down and it put me in a different gear. And so I kind of walk with his spirit of, I had a good life because I've been able to experience so much. And that's the gratitude. It continues to infuse me. I feel like he's always kind of around me. He'll take a walk.
Pai, what do you think your unique skill set or superpower is that's helped you become successful?
Translation. I've been in a lot of rooms. I've been a lot of different types of people. They're a part of me, right? I live globally. I live regionally. I'm not in a box. I don't think any of us are, honestly, but I embrace it. I really do embrace the kaleidoscope of my life's journey so far. And so what I find is that when I'm in conversation or in community with others, I bring other perspectives, whether that is personal or it's professional. And I come with grace, understanding that I don't know if that's right, if that's all those people, if that's actually true. Or I don't know if this is only your issue. I think that there's violence in other places.
Yeah.
Or have we started to see this in a different way? I remember when. And it's not to take anything away from anyone's trials or tribulations or pain, but it's just to open the doors up, especially if certain things haven't been your reality. And so I think I bring that to it. That's what I've heard, is that people feel a level of comfort, that they can be human and vulnerable and it's safe in conversation or community with me. I feel that they say that about my company as well. So that culture has been infused and I feel really proud about that. And I think that's what people seek. Okay, you're going to come and solve this problem. Your brain works really well. But I think that it works that way because I'm looking at it from different viewpoints and I'm taking everyone into consideration. It's just people that we're working for. Who are you serving? How do we make it better?
How do you define the word success? What does that word mean to you?
Freedom. It really does. That's what I called my car in 2020 when I bought it. So freedom to me is about my ability to choose. And you don't always have that. There are a lot of circumstances that will not afford you choice. And so I fight for choice for people. Because we should all have the opportunity to choose how we want to define our lives, not have to fight to have a life. Just to be able to carve out your section and whatever that looks like. And for me, that means that I need to be near the water today. And other times, I need to absorb everything that's happening in the world so I can understand a little bit better. Or sometimes I need to cuddle up with my puppy. I mean, it just depends, right? The fact that I have the freedom to choose more often than not, to me, is success.
To date, what would you say is one of your biggest highs or your greatest wins?
I can't believe that this company is 9 years old. Brad, I didn't know what it was going to be. I mean, I had this idea that I was going to work with artists and year 10, I was going to sell it. And it was just going to kind of be this machine maybe that could work. And what I'm really proud of is that I learn from it every day. It's like its own little organism that has fed so many people. And it is fed by so many people. Like there's this nucleus of information that exists because of all the different types of people that are here. I've lost a client twice in my career. Once I was going through a divorce and my eye was just everywhere else but on my ball. And the second time, I think it's just a myriad of circumstances that had a lot to do with the lack of organization, but it ended. And that was hard, but what I got from it was an opportunity to review it all. I reviewed it from the very beginning, like what happened in this project that it went off the rails? Because that's not usually like us. And I usually don't have the time to stop and look. I'm usually just moving forward towards the next piece of work, the next operational function that I'm trying to fix and adjust. And what I learned was the work that I'm doing is I'm creating little companies for every project. And I had no idea. I thought I was just a consultant. Brought consultants in to work with clients. But because we're virtual, because everyone comes with a specific expertise, because I have a background in education and the work that you do has to be collaborative, we are not the consultant team that goes away and comes back.
Yeah.
you're constantly a part of it. So we can understand, how do you respond to certain things? What's your culture? What's your capacity? There's going to be unknowns. You're going to trust us to lead you through. Maybe you should lead this part. And when I took a step back, I was shocked because there are years that I have 16 little companies going at a time under my banner, right? Mm-hmm. Because there's 16 different groups of people who are working on a particular initiative to just fix it, to build new opportunity. And there is a lot. They've never worked together before. Their new job descriptions, there's a whole culture that's built, and they have to have trust, and they have to have community, and they have to have collaboration, and there's accountability. And when I took a step back and realized, oh, this idea, it works because there's impact, but there's more here. There's a lot more. And so I'd say that's my biggest cry at the moment is sitting on, wow, that's amazing that we have a system and a process to do it. And right now what I'm trying to do is ensure that can live on beyond me.
Legacy. What does the word empowerment mean to you?
That's a great question. Having the ability to have complete self-agency, self to sit in that. I feel like that word is often used to empower others. And I think if you are sitting solidly within yourself, you're clear about who you are and who you're not. There's a little arrogance and plenty of confidence to allow others to be empowered.
Okay, we're going to jump into a little rapid fire section here. So the next grouping of questions, just be 2-3 forward answer type thing. Okay. What is your personal motto?
Do good and do well.
If you were writing your autobiography, what would the title be?
This is why.
How would you describe yourself in one word?
Compassionate.
If you could teach the world one thing, what would it be?
Trust.
What is one thing you love about yourself that is not related to your physical appearance?
My brain.
What is one thing you want but cannot buy with money?
Peace.
And that concludes our rapid fire section. Now back to our regularly scheduled program. Pi, what is one thing that you know now that you wish you knew when you started your entrepreneurial journey?
It's simple. I wish I knew that it was going to be okay. I remember I was talking to my year two. What I knew was that year 1.5, I had to take a step back. I always swap myself. And that's why I teach my students and sometimes my consultants. Let's just figure out where the weaknesses are. So I knew I needed to, before I started the company, I had to get a little bit better at my financial management and my mind management, emotional energy. I couldn't project angst or anxiety. And I needed to make sure that I had no debt because I had an idea, but no one was investing in this idea. And so it was all going to be on my own name. Yeah. And when I started it out, what I realized was I know how to be a consultant, but I've actually never built a business before. That's different. And so this operations and how it all flows together in culture and all of the things that we've talked about today and more. And so I thought about getting an executive MBA. I looked at so many different programs. I settled on one and I talked to a coach before I said yes. And it was the most money I'd ever spent on anything at the time. And as we were talking and starting our work together, it was about a year long and it was a really powerful program. One of the things he said to me was, I think that you have some limiting beliefs. And I said, no, I don't have time. I'm just really stressed. I'm stressed. And he said, I know, because you put stress everywhere on this form. Like I'd have to do it every week, give him some information. He said, stress is the adult word for a lack of trust, right? That you actually feel that you don't trust something that's happening in the world, but we say stress all the time. Instead, it's like the grown-up word for I'm scared. And so for me, I was scared that I had no time and I had no money. And what he asked me to do was to account for my time. So we started out this conversation about how do you spend your time in this prioritization and organization, and then what's your morning like? And I live by my calendar. But one of the things about my calendar that he asked me to do was over the course of a week, I needed to itemize everything I was doing based on four realms of time. So the first one would be my zone. And that's kind of the area that makes my life happy and free. What do I need to do? Do I need to go on a date? Do I need to go for a walk? Do I need to take a nap? Do I need to go to this meeting, write a proposal, sit with my accountant, bookkeeping, all of the things, personal and professional. That's your zone, whatever makes your life substantive and successful. Mm-hmm. Then we have distraction. And distraction is usually when someone is asking you to support their zone. hey, do you have 5 minutes? Can I take you for lunch? Can I talk to you for a minute? And then we have an area where if you have not focused primarily on the work that you're doing, inevitably there'll be some type of disruption. And that has to do with procrastination. You've let something slide too long. Maybe you didn't fire someone you needed to. Maybe you didn't hire someone you needed to. Or you didn't do that report that had to get done. Whatever it is, pay the bill. And now you're having to deal with crisis all the time. And if you are constantly dealing with crisis, something's out of whack. The last one was delusion. And the delusion was really interesting to me. And that comes into the addiction piece that I was talking about. Sometimes it has to do with social media. Sometimes it has to do online gambling. It could be anything that you're not accounting for your time where you kind of zone out. And sometimes you need to zone out. But if you're not accounting for it, there's something that's telling you that it's off. After the full week, what I realized was over 50% of my time was outside of my zone.
Wow.
And when I could see that, the reality was I actually had time. I just wasn't owning it. And I had money because I had just gone on a trip. I had money in my account, but I had these fears and these limiting beliefs, and I hurry and get as much work as possible so that, and then it was compounding on top of me. And why am I doing so much? This is crazy. And so it really helped me to explore and be accountable to myself and make decisions that made sense. Mm-hmm. And then whenever I feel a little bit of angst, I go back to that and I can see, oh, I'm here too much. I need to get back into my zone. I have a calendar that is the zone, color coded, and I can see when am I in it and when am I not. And so if I think about knowing then what I know now, that it's going to be okay and that there's work that is going to be happening to me, this journey has been about my own personal and professional growth. I'm a much better person, leader, colleague, friend than I was when I started this company, because it has forced me to grow in so many ways and also let go. And I know I have even more to do, recovering type A. So I know I'm still quite anal, but I wish I kind of knew that, but I don't think you get to really know it until you go through it.
Yeah, for sure. If you had the opportunity to sit down and have a 1 hour conversation with one woman, any woman in the world, who would it be and why?
I saw your question and I vacillated between my grandmothers. So I grew up with my mother's mother and I would love to talk to her as an adult, but I never really knew my grandmother on my father's side. And I'm so curious to know, she died at 103. What has she seen? I was born in the bicentennial year. So I feel like, oh, I'm going to live 100 years. So I can tell the story of the century. But what a story she had inside of her. I know you said one, but I think about both.
Okay. If you could go back and give your younger self one piece of advice, what would that piece of advice be?
Oh my God, there's so much more of this beyond 36. I only planned at 36. So when I got a divorce, I think I was like 36. And I was like, wait, no, what? It took a while, but there's so much more and I'm so much happier. Let go of all the ideas of who I'm supposed to be.
Lastly, if you were to deliver your last 30-second speech to the world, your corner of the world, your tribe, your people, what would that last 30 seconds sound like? What words of wisdom would you impart?
I hope one day when things get really dark for you personally, and it always happens for all of us, that you don't look for the villain in your story. And you don't see yourself as the victim, but you hold on to the light that is there and that there is purpose in your pain. And it'll push you to something even greater if you really believe that there's work here to do. I know that for me, that's been the case. And even in my darkest hours, when I look back, there's always been a reason for it. It's better not to go backwards, but to go forwards and to know that there's higher ground. I have a friend who calls me the cat of nine tails because she says I'm always landing on my feet. And what I say to her is, why am I always falling, girl? Come on. But what's true is that I'm always reaching for something. I love sitting at the big boys table. Big girls table and challenging and excavating and interrogating. And there are times when I fall and things don't work out the way that I think. But what I know is that I land on higher ground because I look for the lesson and that lifts me up.
Beautifully said. Thank beautiful. Pi, thank you so very much for this incredibly beautiful, powerful, inspirational, thought-provoking conversation. It's been an absolute pleasure and honor having the opportunity to sit and speak with you. Thank you for taking and making the time to be here with me today. And I'm so grateful to have you as a member of the Empowerography community. Thank you. I appreciate you.
Thank you so much for having me. This was so much fun and leaves me with so many things to think about. I really appreciate the time and being a part of it. And I look forward to more with you.
Absolutely. It is my honor and my pleasure. Could you share with the audience where they can connect with you if they want to learn more about you or maybe get involved with some of the things you're doing?
Yeah. So my company is PS314. So that's PS3, the number, and then the words 14. You can always reach out to us there if the work that I'm doing or we're doing is interesting. And then you can always find me as well, Piasis S. Ankara. That's actually my website. And you can learn a lot about my background, some of my writing and my artwork, and reach out if you want me to come and join you for another conversation or a chat.
Beautiful. I will put all that information in the show notes as well. Once again, my name is Brad Walsh, host of your Empowerography podcast. Today, my guest has been Pi Isis. She is a visionary leader, a philanthropist, an educator, an advocate, and the founder of PS314. Thank you so much, Pi. I hope you have a beautiful rest of your day.
You too. Thank you, Brad.
Thank you very much for listening to this podcast. If you haven't yet, please be sure to subscribe, rate, review, and share with all your friends. You can find me at viseuphoria.ca, follow me on Instagram at Empowerography Podcast, and on Facebook at Empowerography. Please join me next time for another inspirational story from yet another amazing woman.